Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the phone line is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilbourne.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you're having a good day. It's a beautiful day here.
Oh, wow. This is why we stay in Iowa for days like today.
Yes, right.
It makes up for all the hot, sticky weather in the middle of the summer and the freezing cold in the middle of the winter. Because
But last winter wasn't too bad, and this summer wasn't too bad.
That's true. So, Caroline, who is our guest today?
Our guest today is Oralee Tila, and she is the author of The Paris Understudy, which is an amazing book. It really is. And so, let's see. She is French-American and lives in Dallas, Texas. She has studied writing at the UCLA Extension School and Bennington Writing Seminars. And I'm sure that she really knows how to search for things, because this book is full of things that took a lot of work.
And she also holds a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science from MIT, which is like the other side of the brain, right? Oralee was born and raised in Belgium. Welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you very much. So there's a little anecdote about my mom I'd like to share. I mean, it's actually in two parts, if you don't mind, because
sure.
You're the only daughter and mom duo that I talked to for this book. And so it took me 12 years on and off to write a book and find an agent and then find a publisher. And my agent, a couple of years ago, had submitted the novel to one run of publishers. There were some close calls, but no one said yes. And that was 15 publishers. And then she sent them to another run of publishers after we had made more revisions. And it was also no one took it on. And then we made more revisions. And the last round, my agent told me there was only 5 editors on the list. And she said, after that, it's going to be a little harder to find a good match, because you really want to target editors you really believe are a good fit for the book. And so, you know, that was a little stressful, because I did spend many, many, many years on it. And my agent had to approve the changes I had made in the last round of revision before she would send it out. And so I did not know when she would actually have time to do it. And so a couple of days went by, and then she sends me an email saying, the book is out, fingers crossed. And that was the 1-year anniversary of my mother's death. And when she told me she had sent it, she did not know, my agent did not know that was a 1-year anniversary of my mother's death. But when she told me, I was like, mom is going to make this work out. It turned out, two of the editors had left the business, two never replied, and then one replied with offer in capital letters in the subject line. So mom made it happen, you know, and that was part one of the story. And I just want really quickly to say also the other part of the story is just a couple of days ago, my publicist texts me and I hear the phone beep, you know, in short succession. So multiple message, and I go to my phone, and the last one is congratulations with 4 exclamation points. And my publicist is typically very level-headed, so I was like, what is going on? And, you know, I have to log in to see all the messages she sent me. And the Washington Post has selected my book as one of 10 noteworthy books for September. And my publicist was typing in all letters, I'm screaming! I was screaming too, I was going to announce. And this happened to be the day that would have been my parents' 50th wedding anniversary.
Aww.
And, you know, I don't want to be too new agey on anything, but I like to think my mom, because she was my biggest supporter, and long before I had an agent or even a finished book, my mom was the one person who believed in me and believed in my writing. And so I like to believe she made it happen somehow. That was my story.
To believe that too, and that's a great story. That's a great story, and congratulations on the Washington Post. That's great news for a debut historical novel.
Thank you.
So, one of the things that the story makes me wonder about is, what were some of the changes that you made that you think made it a sellable manuscript?
So, I always knew it was about two opera singers, Madeleine, who is a very famous one, and Yvonne, who is their understudy. But initially, only Yvonne, being the main character, has a really good character arc. And Madeleine was more like one note because she was like the extreme diva who feels threatened by her understudy. And I realized I needed to give her some growth also because of the war. And that was one big change I made to make her more multidimensional.
Well, she ended up being a more sympathetic character in a way than Yvonne did.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what I walked toward. And also I made a lot of changes for the secondary characters, because initially Madeleine's husband was just a rich owner of a manufacturing plant. And Yvonne's son, Jules, was autistic, but he wanted to be a playwright. And I refocused it on the music. So now Madeleine's husband is a conductor of the orchestra and Jules wants to be a pianist. And those were some pretty important changes that helped me finish the book, because in the previous version, when the secondary characters were not quite hitting the sweet spot, I had a lot of trouble with the middle. And I like to say, people talk about the mushy middle of a book. I had a missing middle. I wrote the beginning, I wrote the end, and I was like, what am I going to do in the middle? I think that's because the characters were just not quite right. And I think I was feeling the block, because somewhere in my mind, I knew they were not right. And I had to fix those characters before I could complete a really good draft of the book.
Well, those changes were substantive. They must have required almost a complete rewrite.
Oh yeah, multiple times. So it took me on and off 12 years to write the book. A couple of years actually just stopped writing, which is why it took me 12 years. I mean, stopped writing that book. I wrote other stuff. But I gave up on the book a couple of times because the rewrites were so substantial. But the story kept staying with me, so I kept going back to it. And there came a point where I was like, I'm going to finish what I started. I can't control if people want to buy the book, if I can find a publisher or not, but I can at least make the book as good as I can. And once I found an agent, and she was so enthusiastic about the book, I was like, maybe I'm onto something. Maybe someone out there is going to write like my book.
So at what point in that 12-year arc did you find your agent?
So it's a complicated story, but about, I want to say, 8 years ago, I took a masterclass at the UCLA Extension School in the writings program, and it's a 9 months long class that is mostly online, but then 1 week in the middle, we go to LA and we all meet each other and we workshop together. And one of the perks of the masterclass was that at the end, an agent from LA would read the first 20 pages of the novel and the query letter and give us feedback. And that was that person, and she loved the beginning. She was like, when it's finished, please let me see it. And at that time, it wasn't finished. So I'm like, oh, it's going to be hard to finish. But I was happy that she was so excited, at least for the first 20 pages. And then a couple of years later, when I was looking for an agent, I emailed her again, and she said, sure, I still want to read it. And she was really enthusiastic, and that's how I found her.
So she's been with you for quite a bit of this rewriting process and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, it lasted for a long time. And she was very good because she's the one who had the idea of submitting in multiple rounds. And so I kept revising in between rounds. But, you know, knowing you have one person in your corner makes such a difference. Like someone else who really likes the book, even if the book initially, you know, still needed a lot of work, somebody who could see the potential. I wish I could say my mom loved it, but my mom doesn't read English. So my mom actually never read the book.
Oh.
but she knew what it was about. And she was like, this is going to be a bestseller. I can feel it. and, you know, that's why I dedicated the book to her.
Oh. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Oli Tila, author of The Paris Understudy. So I'm assuming during this whole time you were working as well, that it wasn't like you were writing full time, that this was something you were doing nights, weekends. What was your writing routine like?
Yeah, I've been always writing early in the morning, in the evening, over the weekends. At the beginning, I would mostly write at the end of the day or during the weekends, and I realized at some point that I'm somebody who thinks better if I write in the morning, and also it gives you a sense of accomplishment. So I like to get up really early and do some writing because this is so important to me, and I like starting the day by doing the thing that is the most important to me before I go to work. And I'm a university professor, and I love teaching and I love research, but there are a lot of meetings in universities, lots of boring meetings, I have to say. And so it helps when you've done your writing first, because you don't want to be sitting in a meeting and start thinking, I wish I could be writing instead of having to listening to this. So, but I love my students. And like you mentioned, I love that my job uses a different part of my brain, because this is also what helps me write even when the university is in session. And I love the contact with the students because they're so eager and enthusiastic that it also gives me energy to keep writing and keep waking up early, even if I'd rather stay in bed.
What school are you teaching at?
Southern Methodist University.
Okay. Yeah. And how long have you been in Dallas?
8 years.
8 years. It's hot there.
And Dallas, sorry?
It's hot there.
Yes. Well, this week hasn't been too hot because we had some rainstorm, but it's definitely very hot, but it's dry heat. And the funny thing is, last time I was at Bennington for the MFA, that was in June, and they had a heat wave. And I felt it way more strongly than I feel it in Dallas, in part because it was humid heat. And somebody looked at me and said, "But you live in Dallas, Texas. How come this is bothering you?" And I was like, in Dallas, everyone has AC.
Yeah.
We in Vermont did not have AC. So
there is
one
that,
building
yeah.
AC, but not the dorms.
And, oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so you get used to it, but mostly you get used to not going out when it's 100 degrees outside.
Yeah.
But I have to say, Dallas has been a very pleasant surprise because there's so much diversity in Dallas. And there are vibrant performing arts venues, which is what I really liked about it. It's the reason why I wanted to go there. And they also love sports, you know, sports events and concerts for people who like that. And the population is also very diverse, especially because you have a lot of refugees from war-torn countries elsewhere in the world who come to Texas because the climate is similar. So you have a lot of people with fascinating stories. Actually, my last Uber driver was a filmmaker in Pakistan whose movie had received awards, but government didn't like it because it was not showing it in a good light, and he was of a minority religion, so he was persecuted for it, and so he managed to receive asylum here, and now he was driving Ubers, you know, and that's the sort of people you often meet in Dallas. And he also wrote a book. I can't remember the title of this book, but it's going to come out soon. And I like how you find those people here where you really feel how people from other parts of the world really admire the United States and just are happy to have their freedom here. So,
well, what brought what brought you to the United States? What made you decide to come here?
Well, I graduated engineering school in Paris right before turning 22. So I was very young. I was younger than all of my classmates. And in France at the time, once people start walking, they don't stop walking. They don't go back to school. That wasn't the mentality. And I thought, I don't want to start walking just now. So I wanted to do a master's in the United States because I had never been to the United States. And I got admitted to MIT. And I came then for my master's at MIT. And then when I was there, I decided I liked it. So I was able to stay on for a PhD. And then I decided I really liked it. And I decided to stay to be a professor in the United States. And around the time where I decided to stay, that's also the time where I decided to switch writing from French to English, because I had been writing novels before in French. But once I decided I was going to stay for the long time here, I decided to write in English. And it's way more complicated than just getting the words right, which was already hard. But the French have a very different syntax, where they tend to write longer sentences, like more convoluted sentences, and longer. And novels in French can be solely character-driven. And here, you still, in the US, you much more need to have a plot and character development. And you have fewer opportunities if you do more experimental writing while in France, that could still find you a publisher. So I wasn't doing really experimental writing, but I was writing in the French style translated in English. And when I reread the early versions of this manuscript, which I still have in my Gmail account, thank you, Gmail. You know, I remember thinking back in the days, I thought it was well written. And now I realize it did not have any grammatical mistakes or anything, which I was proud of because English was not my first language. But I realized the style was not going to be a good fit for the American reader. And, you know, you have to write for the reader as well as for yourself. You don't want to write only for another person. But if you want them to buy your book and spend 300 pages with you, which is many hours, you do have to have a style that is engaging. And the French style translated in English, I realized, was not that engaging, although I liked it initially. And now, you know, the funny thing is when I read a novel in French, I'm just like, oh, no, you should not have gotten it that way.
So is there a possibility that your book will be published in French as well?
We hope so, but we haven't focused on selling the international rights yet because we wanted to launch the book first here and make it a success here. And then it's a lot easier to get translations elsewhere in the world. I would love for the book to be published in France and go back to Paris and have an event at a bookshop somewhere. Hopefully it will. We'll see.
You refer to these operas How did you become familiar with all these operas? Listen to them? Have you heard them? Or
I love this question. Research? Thank you. So my parents were big opera fans, and so I grew up in Belgium, outside Brussels, and they would take me and my brother when we were teens to the opera in Brussels, which is called La Monnaie. So, you know, initially they started with things like Carmen. They did not start with Wagner. And when I moved to Paris, I went to a couple of operas. And the opera house now is at Opéra Bastille. It's no longer at Palais Garnier, which was the location of the opera house during the war. And then when I moved to the United States, for the first few years when I was a doctoral student, I did not have really a lot of time to go to the opera. But then when I took the job in Pennsylvania, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, at Lehigh University, it was only an hour and a half bus ride to New York City. And then I started going to operas at the Met. And I started liking it more and more because the Met, you know, the auditorium is enormous. And even there, you can really feel so many emotions when the singers sing and they don't have any microphone. And it's just the power of the lungs and the voice. And it just moves you at a very deep level. And so I was familiar with a lot of operas. My father is the one who loves Wagner. So he actually dragged us to the Bayreuth Festival a couple of times, not too long ago. And like the first time, it was kind of dragging us, but then I really started loving it. By dragging, I mean he's the one who drives and refuses to let us drive. 10 hours. Driving, and he picks the music too, so that's why I love going to the festival, but the car ride was a memory. And that's where also I saw Tristan Isolde, that plays a key role in the novel, and I also saw The Ring, which also plays a key role in the novel. And then it just became the habit wherever I am, even in Dallas, I have a very good opera company to go and see an opera every so often. It's a unique art form because they need to be good at theater. They need to be good at singing, but no other musician has to sing to a huge crowd without a microphone. And it's pretty much an Olympic sport when you think about it.
Oh gosh, yes. Oh yeah.
Wow. I never really thought about that, how difficult that is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So tell us about the inspiration for this book. And, you know, it's set right before World War II and during, and just after, so that whole period of time. And like you said, there's two main characters, Madeleine Moreau, who is the famous opera singer, the diva, and her understudy, Yvonne Chevalier. Is that how you would say it, Chevalier?
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about these characters, what they're based on, what the inspiration was.
So the inspiration was that about 12 years ago, I learned about an opera singer named Germaine Lubin, was a very famous opera singer in Paris in the 1930s and also during the war. And she was particularly famous for singing Wagner. And she stayed famous during the war because she kept singing and she sang for the Nazis. And she also took on a German lover, a Nazi lover, and associated with the Nazis. She did not ever denounce anyone, as far as we know, but she did socialize with them pretty intensively. At the end of the war, she was arrested and tried for national treason for her behavior during the war. She was put in prison for about a year, and then she lost her French citizenship for a couple of additional years. And she had to live, I think, in Italy for a couple of years before she could return, but even after she could return to France, her career never recovered. No one wanted to hire her, and I thought that was interesting, but I realized pretty quickly that she would not make a very good novel character because she never expressed any remorse for her behavior during the war. And like I said, she never denounced anyone, but she did socialize with people who were very unsavory people. And so she had no character growth. She just said, I wanted to sing. I needed to sing. Singing is my talent. And that was obviously not going to be a very sympathetic character in a novel. And so what I decided to do is to split some of her attributes between Yvonne and Madeleine. So Madeleine got the famous part of Germaine Lubin, you know, the super diva, singing Wagner, being very well established, very successful. And Yvonne got inner drive, the singing with the Nazis, associating with the Nazis, singing for the Nazis, associating with the Nazis. And I kept thinking, well, what could make someone do that? And both Germaine Lubin and Yvonne had a single child, a son, and I decided to make this character's son much younger, and he's a teen, and he ends up at the front in the war when the war is declared. And she, Yvonne, little by little, you know, tries to help him when he's made prisoner of war, tries to save him, and little by little, she gets to crossing the line of what she should really, what is good behavior. And she gets punished for it eventually. I won't say how. She gets punished for it multiple times, but she had a lot of Germaine Lubin in her, including this ambition. And also Yvonne starts a career much later because she had to raise her child when he was little. And so she has this feeling that if her career doesn't take off now, she's never going to make it. So there's a sense of urgency. And I also should mention that when the novel opens, she's still married to the father of Jules, but they divorced pretty quickly, which at the time was not common. And Germaine Lubin also divorced her husband pretty quickly. So she's alone with her son, and her son is her entire world. And then her son enlists for the war, and he gets prisoner of war like all the other French soldiers.
Right. So, and also early on, Madeleine is sort of blocking her career. And so we're at the beginning where we feel pretty sympathetic towards Yvonne and not so much towards Madeleine. But that as time goes on, there's that kind of changes a bit. And I'm curious about, you know, most books that are set in this time period in, you know, we've had a number of authors who've written about the French Resistance, so Paris under the Nazi occupation and different historical novels on, you know, different, usually it's women who are contributing to the resistance effort in some way. And you chose to focus on somebody who maybe could have helped the resistance, but did not. And I'm wondering why you were able to see that in some ways she's just trying to survive. She's trying to survive. She's trying to make sure her son survives. You know, what else is she supposed to do, really? I think we all want to think that we would be brave and courageous and risk our lives, and yet most people did not. Most people just went along like she did.
Yes, exactly. That's what I wanted to have the novel focus on, because it's well known in France, I can say it because I'm French, that there were very few people who dared join the resistance until the very end, when it was clear the Nazis were going to lose. When Paris was first occupied, people had no idea how long this would last, and they thought it could even last throughout their lifetime. And so it's well known in France that most people just kept their head down and tried not to attract attention from the Nazis and the Gestapo, and they were trying to find food. There was rationing, and it was very bleak. And also read some diaries of famous intellectuals during the time. And when the occupation first started in 1940, people had no clue if they would ever live in a free country again. This was just extremely demoralizing. And at the time, very few people thought, I will resist no matter what. Like, active resistance is something that slowly started. And also, I mean, people like De Gaulle, who called for resistance, were in London at the time. So the, you know, people who were actually in France were trying to survive, and that represents the majority of the people initially. And there was only a small fraction who were active collaborators with the Nazi, and a small fraction who were active resistant. And I know it makes for exciting novels to focus on the resistance, and we all wish we would have done the same. But it's really only until, not until 1943, I believe, until Stalingrad, that people really started thinking maybe the Nazi could be defeated sooner than later. And so I wanted to write a novel that would reflect more accurately what it was like at the time in Paris, without judging the people who did not join the resistance. And I wanted to put them in this atmosphere of gloom, and studying the choices they make at a human level.
Oh, I was wondering about Yvonne's son, Jules. Did he not realize what his mother had to do to get him out of the, to get him freed?
Was gone a significant amount of time during the war, whether it was as a front and prisoner of war, and later he joins the Free French. And yeah. I think him being very young and very idealistic, and having seen how badly his mother wanted to become a famous opera singer before the war, and how it was a great passion, I think he does not realize it.
Yeah, I just wondered, because it seemed like, you know, she really gave up a lot, did a lot to get him freed. And so tell me about the free French. What was that? Was that an underground situation, or?
So the Free French were the French who fought in North Africa, for instance, the Nazis, and elsewhere in Europe, and they were led, and in North Africa, they were led by General de Gaulle, who basically kept hope alive during the war from the start, because even as soon as France admitted defeat in 1940, in June 1940, he made this very famous speech saying, we'll fight on until we're free, basically. And because of his example, there were a lot of people who heard about the speech, although it wasn't, like, the BBC was not allowed in France, but they heard about it. And then some people started making little resistance cells here and there, and it was a very grassroots movement that was inspired by the Free French. But the Free French were mostly fighting alongside the Allies, and maybe a little bit in the free part of France. And the resistance, there's a lot of little cells. And a famous one was led by Jean Monnet. And I mentioned it because that was the name of my high school in in Belgium, I went through the French system, and I was a student at the school when the school was renamed Lycée Français de Belgique Jean Monnet. And Jean Monnet was a resistance leader, and he was denounced by somebody, and he was tortured and killed by the Gestapo. But people still remember his example. And so in France, the resistance cells were mostly led by individuals who were inspired by the Free French fighting for them from outside France.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So when it comes to collaborators, you know, it seems like the women got punished more than the men. And also that the women probably had less ability to, I mean, if you got picked out by a Nazi, if they wanted you to be their girlfriend, what choice did you really have?
Yeah, I don't think they had any choice, really. And I think the women and the men got punished very differently for collaboration at the end of the war. So, for instance, the women who had slept with Nazi had their head shaved. They were paraded around the city, and it was a really big black mark. For the men, mostly I think what happened was they may have gotten shot. There were quite a few men who had collaborated with the Nazi who happened to fall off trains at full speed right after the war ended. And they also were tried, some of them, like Robert Brasillach. And Robert Brasillach was executed for what he did because he was the one publishing the addresses where Jews were hiding in his newspaper so that the Gestapo could come and harass them. So he definitely was not a good person. And then after the wave of trials at the liberation of Paris, a lot of people who had received really tough sentences, if they were not killed, so they were still alive, after a few years, the sentences were reduced or even they were pardoned, because after a few years, France decided that moving on was the better way to proceed. And it seems like for the women, the black mark stayed for much longer.
Yeah.
So they got punished differently and it lasted longer.
I mean, in a sense, didn't pretty much the entire Paris police force cooperated with the Nazis? They took their orders from the Nazis. Did they get punished? You could say they were just doing their job. They didn't have a choice, but, you know.
That's a great point, because the Veldiv Roundup, which plays a key role in the book, was orchestrated by the French police who rounded up French Jews, so their compatriots, to ship them off to an internment camp in France first, and then later those people were shipped off to Auschwitz, and the very vast majority of them got murdered in the gas chambers. And it was actually a very enormous source of shame for France for many years, for decades, that the French police had done that. And so for about 50 years, the French would argue that the Vichy government, which was the government of France under occupation, was not a legitimate government, and the legitimate government was Charles de Gaulle and the Free French abroad. And so they would argue, so it wasn't really the French police that did it, because it was not a legitimate government. And it took 50 years for the French president at the time, Jacques Chirac, to formally apologize for the role of the French police in this really, really awful event in French history.
Yeah. So, Arlie, why don't you read a little bit from the Paris Understudy for us?
Sure, I'd love to. Thank you. So I'll read the beginning. So you get to listen to a French person with a French accent read a book set in France. So hopefully that will be a treat for the reader. So, 1. Paris, June 1936. Yvonne Chevalier stepped onto the stage of the National Conservatory of Music as if she weren't afraid. The audience, composed mostly of her competitors' relatives, greeted her with indifferent applause. Soon they were finding themselves with the program again, slumped in threadbare seats. So one burst of clapping surely came from Yvonne's husband and son. She took a place at the edge of the wooden planks, chin high, shoulders back, and turned towards the first row where the judges sat. Beads of sweat ran down her neck. For a moment, she forgot to breathe. At last, she nodded to Madeleine Moreau, the most famous soprano in Paris, who had won the same contest 2 decades earlier and served as that year's judge of honor. Madeleine met Yvonne's gaze, but did not nod back. Yvonne pressed her hands against the sequins of her sleeveless dress. She'd bought the Elsa Schiaparelli gown in a consignment store on the Rivière du Temple. Cut low in front and glittering under the spotlights, the blue dress had raised eyebrows among the other female contestants. They would have ruined their reputation in that dress. But at 32, Yvonne was older, more respectable too, because she was married, and she could wear clothes they could not. The gown matched the color of her eyes and brought out the golden shade of her hair. She wasn't above trying to impress the judges by every means. Madeleine tapped the lead of her pencil onto her notebook. She was more heavyset than Yvonne always had been, even before the trips to sing all over Europe, London, Milan, Vienna had taken their toll. She claimed to have turned 48 that spring, but it was an open secret that she was 54 and dyed her hair raven black every other week. A Vionnet dress in red silk chiffon stretched awkwardly across the balls of her hips. Her jawline sagged. She enjoyed enough fame, though, that opera singers who believed she could help them claimed to see remnants of great beauty in her. Her most striking feature was her eyes, piercing like those of a falcon. Yvonne searched for Paul and Jules in the few seconds she had before the crowd became impatient. She found them on tattered armchairs, 8 rows behind the judges, at the exact spot Yvonne had told them to sit, where a voice would best merge with the music. Paul, a mop of hair falling over his face, wore a wrinkled linen suit that hung loosely over his shoulders. He looked anxious about Yvonne's performance. Both Yvonne and he knew much depended on it. Jules, seemingly older than 15, in the Sunday clothes Yvonne had ironed for him, showed the tip of a pencil. It relieved Yvonne to find him. Locating her son in the room would bring her good luck, she was certain of it. She dabbed a handkerchief on the back of her neck and gave a signal to the accompanist. Yvonne had chosen the Visi d'Arte area in Tosca. She loved picturing herself as a famous singer who anguishes about the fate of her beloved after a dictator's henchman has captured him and wails that God has abandoned her. Opera wasn't known for minor storylines, which suited Yvonne perfectly. Her life had been insignificant enough. She enjoyed imagining herself in someone else's skin. Audience members, sitting up after a first bar of music, leaned forward in their seats. Yvonne's voice rose in the hall and wrapped itself around them like a spell. She lived for moments like this, for the way the energy in a room shifted when she shared a gift with the world. The feeling she was doing what she'd been put on earth to accomplish, and the certainty no one could replace her if she remained silent. While the other contestants had only sung, she acted too, shook her head in sorrow, paced the floor, conjured a memory with a sweep of her arm. Most opera singers demonstrated little acting skill, but Yvonne became Tosca in that instant. She hoped, no, she was sure, spectators would come only to support their relatives, for God, they sat in a hot, dreary room near the Gare Saint-Lazare and found themselves transported into other worlds, thanks to her artistry. The applause thrilled Yvonne when she finished singing. She expected her competitors' relatives to keep their acclaim for their family member, and Paul and Jules couldn't make that much noise on their own. Yvonne bowed left and right, grateful the crowd had appreciated her aria, and struggled not to lose their balance in the emotion of the moment. What a pity the little ladies of Dijon didn't attend. Those women who'd ostracized Yvonne's parents after they counted the months between her wedding and the birth of her son. 7 months, God help us, the end of civilization is coming nigh. The one Yvonne became a famous opera singer, the Meyer would host a luncheon for her at the Grand Hotel La Cloche, and the notables' wives would have to sing her praises 20 different ways before she sat down next to them. At last, Yvonne saluted the judges. She searched Madeleine's face for a hint of approval, but didn't find any. Her smile vanished. She stared at Madeleine, almost imploring. Madeleine waved the back of her hand at Yvonne with the nonchalance of a queen dismissing a subject. And I'll stop here.
Thank you. And that was Aurélie Tilla reading from The Paris Understudy. So this book comes out in a few days from when
September
we're recording.
10th, yeah.
September 10th, 2024, because who knows when somebody might be listening to this. And you mentioned you had written novels before in French. Had any of them, did you ever publish any French, any novels in French?
No. I was very young. I was a high school student.
So
I did finish a novel in French, but it was not very good.
Okay. And so this is your first time seeing, this will be your first time seeing your book on the shelves. Are you excited?
Yes, I was very, very excited. And, you know, it's great also to see it in hardcover, because these days a lot of books get published in paperback right away instead of being in hardcover first.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep looking at my book. I can't quite believe this happened. The funny thing is the publisher didn't tell me when they were sending the copies of the book to my house. And so first there were paperbacks that are the advanced reading copies. And a little bit later, the final book was ready for publication and they sent me the hardcover. And both times they did not tell me. And for the advanced reading copies in paperback, there was nothing special about the books. And I had ordered something from Amazon. And so I just put the book inside the house and I had other things to do. And after a few hours, I was like, wait, if it was my Amazon package, the packaging would be different. And I open it and I'm like, oh,
I have your book.
Copies. And then a couple of weeks later, I see this huge box in front of my house. And I was like, huh, because this time I was pretty sure I had not ordered anything, but could have been, you know, a mistake, maybe a package for my neighbor. And I get closer and there's Penguin Random House written in big letters on it because they distribute the novels by Alcove Press, which is my publisher. And then I knew that was my book. And that box I could not open fast enough. And it's an amazing feeling. You know, to see your book in physical format.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, of course.
And So Penguin Random House, that's pretty major. You know,
Yes, we were very lucky. We were very lucky because small presses have struggled with the distribution. A key distributor for small presses went under recently. And so we feel very fortunate that we have a major distributor to put our books in the bookstore. Yeah, we're very grateful.
So tell me a little bit about Alcove Press.
Well, it's an imprint of Crook Lane Books. And my editor there is Holly Ingraham. And she used to be a senior editor at St. Martin's Press, I believe. And they wanted to... I believe, you know, Crook Lane Books and Alcove Press wanted to focus on great reading material for the public, especially women's fiction and a couple of other themes they have. And this has allowed me to get a lot of attention from my editor. And I mean, all our authors get a lot of attention compared to you know, bigger publishing house where you're just one among many. And I've really enjoyed this close collaboration on how responsive they've been to me. And it's been a little bit of a whirlwind because I think I signed the contract at the end of July last year. And then I had to make some changes because she made development edits and line edits. And I think it was just about a year ago that she okayed it, and I learned it would get published in September. And I think it was 11 or 12 months lead time before publication when I learned about it, which is kind of short. Typically, it's closer to 16 or 18 months.
Yeah.
But because it's a smaller company, so it's not as this huge bureaucracy, so they could move faster. And we were able to bring the book to life for the September season, which is a really good season to sell books.
Well, Crooked Lane Books, I'm looking at their website. They were founded in 2014 to publish crime fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2020, they added Alcove Press to publish Upmarket Book Club fiction that explores family, friendship, and community.
Yes, and the book has been selected also by their Penguin Random House library recommendation system as a must-read book for book clubs.
Oh, wow. So do you have any book clubs? Like, do you do talks to book clubs? I know that some authors do that.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to. So, yeah, if anyone wants to have me on Zoom for their book club, I would love to talk about the book to anyone who is interested.
Awesome. So now that, you know, this book is out in the world, are you working on another book?
Yes. So I mentioned it took me 12 years to get this one to publication because it was on and off. And when I had given up on this book for a while, I had started another novel that is maybe 75% finished. So it's not quite almost finished, but it's going to get finished pretty soon. It's about a young school teacher in Madrid at the end of the Spanish Civil War. And she's married to the son of a very, very wealthy family, and the family was nationalist, which in those days, the nationalists were the people who were supported by the church was the very wealthy, and that was the side of General Franco. That was the side that won, and he started a dictatorship after the end of the Civil War, and she is a Republican. And the Republicans in Spain at the time were the ones fighting for democracy. And, you know, everybody has a right to vote, and women have the right to vote also, and so on. And she convinced her husband to switch from nationalist to Republican, and he wrote speeches for the war ministry. And now her side has lost, and the side of her husband's parents has won. And the husband ends up getting arrested by the nationalists, a little bit like as a side arrest, because he was not the main person they had come to arrest. And now she has to figure out how she can free him. And maybe staying in Spain had been a really bad idea. She wanted to stay in Spain because she didn't want to lose everything she had. She had been very poor, and she wanted to cling to the hope she could make a life in Spain and open her own little teaching school. And she only has a couple of days to figure out what to do. And at the same time, she's also helping other Republicans hide from the nationalists who are trying to arrest a very famous officer from the Republican side. Mm. So you can tell I don't have it nailed down to a log line yet, but I'm really excited about this book. I love writing about strong female characters put in very difficult circumstances and the maelstrom of history. So I hope to share it with you pretty soon.
Now, is she based on a actual historical character as well?
No. I got interested in that time period because my aunt, who was my mother's sister, who was also my godmother, really loved Spain. And when I learned more about the Spanish Civil War, I realized the tensions between nationalists and Republicans at the time are quite similar to the tensions we see as a country today. And both sides feel they're very right, and the other side has lost their mind. And we need to, you know, take drastic action to save the country and so on. And I wanted to explore those families that got torn apart because, for instance, in the book, the parents are nationalists and the son became a Republican and the parents feel it was a betrayal. And the school teacher, who is the son's wife, is a hardcore Republican and feels nationalists are completely insane. And throughout the book, she also comes to realize they are more multidimensional than she thought, at least her in-laws. And, you know, I was thinking at some point we'll have to have some sort of quote-unquote reconciliation in our country because the tensions, the political tensions is there are so strong, and good people have been torn apart and families have been torn apart, and we need to think about how we'll move forward. And I felt exploring it in this novel could help show the way forward in some way, or maybe show it's helpless.
It's not like we haven't been through this before. We had an actual civil war in this country, you know, tore families apart. Sometimes you had people fighting on opposite sides.
Yes.
In that war. So I don't know what it is about humanity that we keep repeating this.
It's very true.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll make through it.
Yes, hopefully we will. And like you said, in Paris, it seemed so dark and so hopeless when the Nazis were occupying. And yet now look at Paris now.
Yes. And you know, the dark years ended up lasting only 4 years. So sometimes it seems very gloomy, but there's always hope and light at the end of the darkness.
And Paris is the city of light.
Yes, it is.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Aurélie. We're about out of time, and we always close with a quote from Mom when she's on. So what do you have for us today?
Well, it seems to me that those of us who have never experienced our lives invaded by a war where we live are extremely fortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well said.
And, yes. And, you know, our hearts go out to the people who are dealing with that today in Ukraine, you know, other places in the world where it's amazing how they survive, and books, historical novels in particular, can help us see how people survive in those circumstances. And this was very interesting because it really got you to think about what choices would I make if I were in that situation.
That's right.
Yeah. So thank you, Aurélie, and good luck with your next book.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.